The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
In any given week, I have an email from our head of counterterrorism saying, okay, we're now seeing uptake of this particular over-the-top technology or this particular technology. What can we do with it? And the answer more frequently than not lately is, that's a level of encryption that is incredibly challenging and that we don't necessarily have the capabilities to work with.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, Special Edition, Part 4, Inside NSA. We brought in a recording device so you don't have to do it. We exfiltrated many gigabytes of data in the form of podcast interviews with five of the agency's senior management team. Nearly half a gigabyte of that data was this interview with Anne Neuberger. She's got a job I don't envy at all. She's the head of NSA's Commercial Solutions Center, which is to say the agency's liaison with the U.S. private sector. A lot of U.S. industry is really upset with the agency right now. Companies don't like having their compelled cooperation with NSA made public. They really don't like not being able to talk about it. And they really, really don't like the suggestion that NSA may be tapping the pipes between their overseas data centers and cracking their encryption. We sat down with Neuberger to talk about the future of NSA's relationship with the private sector. Is the cooperation drying up? Is there a real threat of going dark? Has NSA put companies in a terrible position with respect to their ability to do business overseas? It's the Lawfare Podcast, Inside NSA, Part 4. So let's start with you. What exactly do you do here? What is your portfolio? And how does one come to manage NSA's relationship with industry?
Mm-hmm. First, what do I do? So I'm responsible for, as you say, overseeing our work with the U.S. private sector. As you know, and I think you heard earlier from Lonnie, the breadth of technology is staggering, and the rapid advances occurring on a daily basis. So NSA works with those technologies, both in terms of our foreign intelligence mission and in terms of our information assurance mission. That's the same technologies that's running on our desktops here, in our server rooms, as well as across the U.S. government. So we work with companies both to understand different technologies that are likely to be used by entities around the world, by some of our foreign intelligence targets. And we also work with them to really raise the security of those products as much as we can, because those are the same products we're using here. So we have a great we have a great reliance and dependence on commercial technology because, as I said, it's the security we're using, it's the communication tools we're using all across our enterprise. I missed your second question.
Yeah, the second question, how does one come to mm-hmm. do that sort of thing? What's your background and where mm-hmm. do you come from?
That's a great question, and mine is an unusual background for an NSA senior, so it's actually a fantastic question in the degree to which it speaks to NSA as a culture. So I'm on NSA's senior leadership team, and that's because there is that much of an importance and emphasis placed on work with the private sector. How I came to NSA is somewhat of a left-turn path. I came from the private sector. I have a background in computer science and policy. I had started at a financial services business right out of college, and I started running IT, information technology, and then I migrated to running operations for a roughly $800 million business. And it's so interesting because sometimes I think that many of the issues we'll talk about here, which are how our policy issues keeping up with technology impacted us way back then in terms of, for example, how we did record storage. So I ran operations. Back when I had been in business school, I had a professor tell me about a program called the White House Fellows Program. It brings in individuals from all across the U.S., from a breadth of backgrounds, to bring them into government, to give them a picture of government, hopefully give them an appreciation of the challenges of government and an interest in serving at some time. I came in 2007. I was rather unexpectedly, the agencies get to pick among the class of 14. I was assigned to the Department of Defense. I had had no military background, pure financial services, pure IT. But at the time, I was assigned to work for Secretary Gates, the Secretary of Defense. He had a tremendous emphasis on acquisition improvements, how to ensure that technology was best used across the military, so he valued that part of my background. And I love languages. I speak a number of languages, so there was that piece. I served there for a year. I moved to work for directly the Secretary of the Navy on a number of enterprise-wide Navy IT programs that were challenged. And then after about a couple of years, General Alexander recruited me when they were standing up Cyber Command on their small implementation team. I was part of a fantastic team standing up the command. And then I moved over to working a number of public-private partnership efforts on cybersecurity, figuring out how we operationalize sharing of classified and unclassified threat signatures. And then I moved over to running this organization that oversees all of our interactions with the private sector. So a combination of rich private sector background and more in terms of a rich appreciation for the issues that private sector is seeing today, and I feel a tremendous sense of responsibility for that as well.
So when most people think of NSA's relationship with the private sector, I think the view of it is heavily conditioned by these very angry statements that
Absolutely.
A lot of major internet companies have been making mm-hmm. publicly, lawsuits, professions of great surprise mm-hmm. at certain news stories. When you talk about NSA's relationship with industry, it's a much more complicated thing, and mm-hmm. things that you've just said, you described how dependent NSA is on secure technologies.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably you're referring as well to cooperation and collection. How would you characterize, as a general matter, the agency's relationship with U.S. industry and private sector?
So that's an interesting set of questions there. I was just scribbling some thoughts as you talked. So first, as you said, we have a tremendous reliance on secure technology. It's all across the enterprise. Lonnie talked to you earlier about some of our challenges in terms of looking at insider threats. So first and foremost, we use those technologies in our day-to-day. So independent of any interactions with the company, it's in our interest to improve that security. And when we find vulnerabilities in those products, we share them with companies. We work to raise the level of security as much as we can. U.S. companies are at the forefront of innovation and advances in technology. And they're world leaders in many ways. Those comments that were made, we certainly appreciate the impact to their reputation that has occurred via the media leaks. And we feel a sense of responsibility to look at that because we could have done a better job in how we communicated some further information about those programs, both in terms of how we communicated. A good example were some of the initial comments about NSA having direct access to servers. That was fundamentally wrong. We wanted to go back in. We were not as effective as we could have been going in and saying, all Western democracies have these kind of lawfully compelled programs where they work with their main providers and they say, they come in, and the United States has a tremendous amount of oversight across the three branches of government for that. We actually believe there's more oversight in programs that the U.S. government has, those lawfully compelled programs, than in other countries. But explaining just the degree to which they're compelled to participate in those programs, the degree to which such programs are common among Western democracies, and the degree to which companies across the world, U.S. and foreign, are compelled to share user information subject to that legal oversight as required. So I think we recognize our responsibility, Ben, to have done a better job to communicate that. And we recognize the impact to the company's reputations and the degree to which they've been working, as they've had for a number of years, to convey the need for transparency in these programs. I think U.S. companies have done a terrific job. When you look at things like Microsoft and other companies' transparency reports, you see the set of requests they get from all around the world. They list country by country and the set of requests. And they've really been leaders in that way on transparency. And I think we'd like to do everything we can, both to support them in those transparency efforts, which are very necessary, and also, and this comes the final point, we're an intelligence agency, and secrecy is a big part of the way an intelligence agency operates. Because, as I said earlier, our foreign intelligence targets can change the technologies and the communication tools that they use very easily. They can change that more quickly than we can pick up where they go to. So as a result, secrecy is a part of our business. On the other hand, we serve an American public. And if they don't understand what we're doing, and they question what we're doing, then we've missed a big part of doing our job.
A moment ago, you mentioned private sector entities and their transparency reporting, including in particular the reporting on general numbers of responses to particular lawfully authorized requests. In the public record, there are attempts through litigation by some of these entities to get permission to be much more granular as to the particular kinds of authorities and responses from the government opposing that. Can you shed any light on why the government might not be comfortable with that greater level of granularity?
I'll share it at a high level.
Sure.
Because it's important to do so. So at a high level, we certainly, there's always a balance between security and transparency, as we talked about. Currently, and we certainly believe that sharing the scope of that, you know, from some of the, it's important that the average user understands there are billions of users around the world. The really relative small scope, we're very focused on a foreign intelligence lawful intercept in terms of, for example, also enforcement of just law enforcement routine. So it's important that folks see just what a small percentage that is, so in terms of the scope of government requests. And I believe, from a government perspective, the government's committed to releasing an annual report that covers all the providers to demonstrate that scope across. Company by company, companies are permitted today to also convey the scope of company-by-company requests, and there were, many of them are already doing so. I think some of the requests then went into detailed figures by various platforms, and we had concerns as to the impact on how much that would give guidance to foreign intelligence targets to change the tools that they use to communicate. And as I mentioned earlier, it is difficult for us to track that when that happens, and that was the concern. As you know, there's litigation on that, so I probably can't go much further. But that's pretty, that's really the core reason, a concern that that balance, that we had the balance right in terms of them, companies being permitted to share the scope, and that beyond that, that would be, at least from the government's perspective, out of balance.
So you were talking before about how how the agency provides companies with a, with information about vulnerabilities in their products to improve levels of security. But one of the fairly consistent themes of some of the sort of Snowden-era news stories has been that NSA has, eroded cybersecurity standards, built-in back-end access to or acquired back-end access to commercially available products. I'm curious, without asking about any specific story or allegation, I'm curious about what you can tell us about that category of suggestion, and also what the evolution of the agency's attitude towards security and commercial products has been over time.
So, one of the most challenging parts of the last few months has been seeing the impact to some of the most innovative and important technology companies from some of the media allegations. We don't believe that the concerns are founded. And I think what we've been trying to balance, and you've heard it in some of our statements when we say we use the technologies that we advocate for, whether it's in a standard or in working groups we participate in, and we advocate for the technologies that we use. So at some point, we said we feel that we need to take responsibility for the impact to the company's brands in that way, from some of these media allegations, and say, we really do believe that those allegations are unfounded, and then look to the future and say, how do we continue to stay current with technologies that we use and that we seek to collect on, but still do it in a way that gives companies the distance and makes it very explicit their role in those efforts. So, for example, and I think some of the transparency we just talked about is a big piece of that. It's a lot harder to, after a media allegation has come out, say, you know, to prove something is false or true. We think a better approach in the coming months, and it's certainly something that each of us start by sitting here, it's the reason we so value these opportunities, thank you, is along the way to explain more about what we're doing, to explain some of the challenges that we face. Encryption is a good example, and we can talk about that in a moment. We'll talk about that when you talk about the evolution. And help folks understand how we work, the principles by which we work, so that there's that understanding when an allegation comes out, folks can say, does that fit within the principles and the operating rules, the oversight frameworks, and the legal frameworks that we now understand govern NSA's operations? And that goes to the evolution question you just asked me. You know, so in the late 90s, it's actually interesting, I finished a terrific book over the weekend called Crypto by Stephen Levy. I'll give him a shout out. It's a good book. And it talks a lot about, it's particularly interesting for me because I am a relatively recent newcomer to NSA. I joined NSA only 4.5 years ago. And it talks about the period before the relaxation of export controls, how there was kind of one set of encryption inside the U.S. and one set of encryption outside. The U.S. government controlled the export of encryption because of a sense that encryption really was a protection against U.S. government surveillance and the concern that that would get into the hands of foreign intelligence targets and, you know, the term going blind or going dark. The U.S. government, whether for law enforcement purposes, domestic purposes, or overseas purposes, wouldn't be able to kind of protect the nation in terms of gathering that kind of information. And at the end of the 90s, there was a recognition that crypto was a core part of the new technologies, innovation, web commerce, and that first, U.S. companies were lobbying strongly that they were being shut out of a global market because of unique U.S. export controls, and also a sense that there was huge opportunity for innovation in this space if there was the sense that technology could be fully trusted for authentication and for security. So export controls were relaxed, and that was a wonderful thing. It led very much to the technologies that we all see that are part of our lives every single day. Along that time, what it also led to was that across the U.S. government, there was a realization that we needed to be a part of that innovation. We wanted those technologies inside. You know, Lonnie's talked about, I see the difference, my life outside NSA in terms of what I have at my fingertips and my life when I come into work. That's important. And that's a divide that we can understand. But on the other hand, there was a recognition that we wanted to use a Windows, in our case, operating system, that we wanted to use, you know, Cisco, Juniper, etc., routers. We wanted to use commercial technologies because they were best in class. And government-produced technologies, other than for the absolute top limit in nuclear command and control, was not as cost-effective, as innovative, or as user-friendly. Couldn't help folks do what they wanted to do. So that's what kind of brought together those commercial markets where governments around the world, so looking at the U.S. first, you talked about the evolution of our use, we use the commercial technologies that at work that we use outside. Those technologies also now are in our foreign intelligence target's hands. So we look at the average counterterrorism target. On any given day, it's probably more accurate to say, in any given week, I have an email from our head of counterterrorism saying, okay, we're now seeing uptake of this particular, you know, over-the-top technology or this particular technology, what can we do with it? And the answer more frequently than not lately is that's a level of encryption that is incredibly challenging and that we don't necessarily have the capabilities to work with. So when we look at that, you know, that's that evolution has come to be.
So this is the constant risk of going dark, a constant fear. And mm-hmm. this never entirely goes away because mm-hmm. the pace of technological change will mm-hmm. always be fast and it will always mm-hmm. continue to change. One element of the post-Snowden story is the idea that it may be that the set of events and narratives surrounding it will incentivize other countries to pull away from American service providers of various kinds, mm-hmm. developing more indigenous technological capacities or, mm-hmm. or whatever it is, but just shying away from American providers. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is happening, and if so, does it accelerate the threat of going dark?
It's an interesting question. So first and above all, as I mentioned earlier, the framework or the assumption that providers around the world are not all subject to lawfully compelled providing user data in response to government requests, that's just a false assumption. As I mentioned earlier, you know, virtually every Western democracy, and we know in non-Western democracies it's a non-issue because there's just absolute surveillance, there's censoring, etc. So I'm focused on Western democracies. It's a common government need to, when needed, to have access to user data subject to, in the United States, very careful legal oversight to be sure that there's a real purpose for it. And then certainly oversight across all three branches to then validate and make sure it's reasonable as well as lawful. So I think I would first just set that assumption to say, you know, governments around the world have very similar requirements. The U.S. government is unique, we believe, in the degree of oversight across all three branches of government, both in terms of the reasonableness and the lawfulness. And then finally, the companies around the world are subject to the rules of the countries they operate in. That being said, one thing that is somewhat unique is that the global major web platforms, and this is a tribute to the innovation and the creativity of U.S. entrepreneurs, are generally the leading global platforms around the world. And a vast majority of their users are foreign. So we in the U.S. do have an obligation to ensure that we take that into account and that we treat that accordingly. That's a tremendous obligation. These are global businesses. And we want to be sure that no U.S. government actions impact the ability of those companies to innovate and most certainly to be trusted by their users around the world. So that is a critical part. Looking forward, that's something we have to carefully consider every single day in the decisions we make and the degree of transparency, ours and theirs.
But there's a very deep tension there, right? I mean, if you say, number one, NSA is highly dependent on its relationships with the platforms that people use, the companies that run...
I said the technologies, not so much the relationships, the technologies there.
Okay,
yes.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Number two, the overwhelming majority of these companies' customers are non-Americans overseas, which mm-hmm. is to say people who NSA would typically regard as potential, mm-hmm. to the extent that they have foreign intelligence information, mm-hmm. Potential targets. And three, that we want to not do anything that would compromise our private sector in its ability to mm-hmm. innovate and recruit such people as customers. That seems like a circle that's very difficult to square to me, because on the one hand, the fundamental interest of the companies is to attract such people as customers, and the fundamental interest of NSA is to get access to the information that those people may be using those technologies to get. How do you square that? And particularly in a world of transparency, where the answer can't be entirely, you help us and we'll be very, very mm-hmm. quiet about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, to a certain extent, transparency is our biggest friend. So eight U.S. companies came out with a call to government on Monday with regard to surveillance reform. And they called for, and first that call was very helpful to us because they were sharing their thoughts on how to square that circle, Ben, because you're exactly right, Ben. It's a difficult issue. And the thoughts they had to share thought were incredibly helpful. And I think to the point you're making, so first the point you're making, it's a hard problem. Fundamentally, communications are intermixed. You have, you know, what we call here bad guy comms and good guy comms, and they're intermixed. You can't touch a bad guy comm without touching a good guy comm. You know, General Sandu talks about it. He wishes we can kind of put our arm away there and say, okay, anybody's planning something malicious towards U.S. government and our allies around the world, you know, why don't you communicate on that platform right there, and that's just about good. That was to a certain extent, pre-export control relaxation world. It's not today. So that's the first piece. And in the company's calls, they called for five things. The first thing they called for was greater codifying the legal oversight under which some of these programs operate. That was the first. I'll get back to that. The second was greater transparency, that the companies could have the right to be more transparent. I think they were asking as well as for greater government transparency. There was a number three, greater oversight. We'll talk about that. And then the final two, they focused on, you know, calls for governments not to balkanize data by having requirements that data be stored locally, country by country, and then calls for government not to censor data. So certainly all of those five are very global principles. They're principles that they were calling on all governments. And I think to your point about, we were talking about in terms of communications are intermixed, the companies have the ability, and they've taken strong steps, they've announced those steps, to deploy encryption to protect communications. From our information assurance mission, from all of our missions, we fully support that in terms of companies doing what they need to protect their users' data. That's their first and primary responsibility. They need to do what they need to do to protect that user data, and we support them. From the perspective of have a legal framework and communicate what that is, we believe that legal framework exists. It exists in programs like 702, was colloquially called PRISM. And perhaps what we've learned, and that's what I meant when I said transparency, is a good friend. Perhaps what we've learned is that, and it's hard for us, because we're an intelligence agency, and it is far easier for an intelligence agency to operate in the shadows. Perhaps what we've learned is, if we communicate how we lawfully compel, the procedures, how carefully it is determined why we need to target a particular user's communications, how we request it, how carefully that's done, what the oversight of that is across the government, I think then you have folks looking at that and saying, yes, security and privacy, security and liberty are in any society requirements. They need to live together. Here's the framework of how it lives together in the United States. And then looking at that and understanding that. Because I think one of the pieces we've seen, we've been learning this together, is when people have no visibility into that, there's this perception that security is almost happening without folks working every single day to do the work to make that security a part of our lives. And I think for those of us who've traveled around the world, we know that security is not a part of everybody's lives all around the world. So helping the average citizen understand, and not in tremendous detail, because who has the time? I'm not sure there's necessarily the interest in that, but to understand, here's the framework by which your government, whether for law enforcement or national security, does that. Here's the framework, you know, web platforms are the ways people communicate around the world. Good guys comms and bad guys comms. Because they're ubiquitous, they're easy to use, they're free. As a result, government has a way to work within a careful framework with key companies to lawfully compel those companies under a framework that makes sure there's good reason for it, makes sure there's oversight of it. And that actually happens all around the world as well. And to communicate that, so citizens understand that, you know, I think, like, as you said, it's a core challenge in that there needs to be that relationship, that way to compel. On the other hand, maybe it's a good thing that, not maybe, I think it is a good thing that folks come to understand that in some way. Sorry.
So in the time you've been dealing with these relationships with the private sector at NSA, have you noticed a change in which an increasing slice of the private sector contains companies, the leadership of which, or maybe even the corporate ethos of which, is committed to more libertarian or privacy-oriented visions that explicitly reject the idea of what they might characterize as undue cooperation, or even perhaps any cooperation other than what's absolutely forced upon them with government? Is that a trend? Is it continuing today? Has it plateaued? Or is it maybe accelerating?
Clearly, the last few months have been challenging. They've been challenging because, as I mentioned earlier, that foundational knowledge wasn't there. So we got a lot of requests of, well, I just read that in the paper, you know, is that true? So you spend a lot of time talking with folks, you know, and helping them understand the framework, understand the controls, etc. The company's first and primary obligation is to serve their customers and to have the trust of their users. And we support whatever they feel they need to do in that framework. But you hit on a core problem that's not something new here. As I was reading, for example, crypto, I saw this has been discussed for years in terms of how do you find that balance? And that's something that I'm a firm believer just generally. Anytime there's a balance, you need the conversations to hear different perspectives to understand where that balance needs to be at any point in time. You know, one might say that the average American, you know, we serve the American public, we're answerable to them. The average American's perspective on that balance would have been something on, you know, September 9th, 2001, different on September 13th, 2001. It may well be different beginning of December 2013. And I think what we gain from having these discussions back and forth, talking with corporate stakeholders, talking with folks on the Hill, talking with privacy individuals, and NSA will be having a civil liberties and privacy officer, so it's a full-time focused position, is understanding whether our perception of that balance is right at a point in time. And, you know, kind of holding the organization accountable to be as transparent as we need to be. And then it is our responsibility to gather the communications American policymakers need to keep the country safe.
You mentioned earlier in our discussion the speed of change, the speed of technology. Mm-hmm. There is a high rate of change, of course, famously. Policymaking isn't known for its high rate of change, high speed of change.
You've noticed.
Lawmaking even more so, right? And so one question that arises is whether or not it is foolish to think that policymaking can ever keep up with the disruptive impact of technological change. Are we in for a perpetual cycle of the technology moving on the ground, and then we eventually mm-hmm. have some sort of moment, maybe not as dramatic as June of 2013, mm-hmm. but something like this, in which the public wakes up and suddenly there's an effort to lurch forward with policy to adapt mm-hmm. to that changed technology. Are we locked into this cycle?
Personally, I love the balancing or the translation of technology to law, law to technology, technology to policy, policy to technology. You know, it was, I was thinking about this actually as I was driving into work and thinking about the podcast today. So back when, this is going back about 12 years ago, I'll come to answer your question. I was running operations at a large financial services business. So the financial services business did all back-end works. So anytime you sold shares, you got a dividend check, there was a corporate action, a company bought another company, we processed, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of those transactions every year for roughly 2,000 public companies. And I still remember, and we would keep warehouses. So by law, we were required to retain a record of all transactions for 7 years. I don't know what the current legal requirement is. And we literally kept warehouses under lock and key because we were required to keep a record. 12 years ago, I recall, we were proposing that we be permitted to scan, image, shred the original, scan, image, and make available to folks at their desktop. There's a clear business reason. A shareholder would call and say, well, I did not sell those shares to Ben. Yeah. And we'd have to pull up the paperwork, and look at the legal paperwork, etc., that underpinned it. The notary, was it a proper notarized document, etc. It used to take several weeks till we can get to one of the warehouses. You know, we had paper records that told us which warehouse it was in, find it, etc. And at that time, the policy discussion was, when the law says retain a record, could that be an electronic record? Or did it need to be a paper record? And I remember actually arguing this with our OGC, who felt strongly the law said a paper. You know, when it said record, it meant a paper record, because only paper records were generally industry accepted at that time. So the compromise we came to was that we would do both. And after 6 months, we would start doing both. And then at a three-month period, we would start querying our electronic repository first. And after 6 months of that, if in 100% of the time we were able to locate the electronic record, we would start shredding documents because we knew we had a satisfactory record. And we did that. And quite candidly, once everybody started using it, of course they bought it, and the records were there with a higher likelihood. But I recall that issue because it was a really difficult issue with an attorney saying, no, it's a paper record, because his mental model was, that's the only record there is. That comes to the question you asked, which is policy and technology. I think policy will always be playing catch-up to technology. So long, especially, and the issue I think is exacerbated in government because sometimes policymakers don't either take the time or don't have the ability to stay current with technology. And sometimes technologists say, oh, I don't want to touch that policy. It's boring stuff. And fundamentally, it needs to come together. I see it in the work we do almost every single day. So I think, yes, it will play catch-up, but I think each of us in the roles we're in can do more to try to help that come together. And I think some of our work with companies, what our hope is that we can have those conversations and engage and say, you know, we recognize you are at the leading edge of American innovation and technology. You're leading the economy. U.S. economic security is a key concern. How do we ensure that our U.S. law and U.S. policy is, even if not running abreast with technology, at the very least, not so far behind that our, or having the discussion of how to make sure that our technological, that our policy frameworks, our oversight frameworks, keep very much in touch. And I think if you talk to John DeLong, he'll talk about how much he's looking to do compliance in an automated way, for example, to help bridge that as closely as he can.
So I want to come back to the question of encryption. And specifically, you know, you've described how the agency is using commercial encryption to secure its own materials and communications. And that would argue for a agency commitment to very strong encryption systems in the commercial sector. On the other hand, you're also a signals intelligence agency that has to collect other entities' communications and be able to make sense of them, which would argue for either weaker standards or very strong abilities to break them. And I'm speaking of circles that require squaring. Where does that leave the agency with respect to commercially available encryption?
So generally, General Alexander's guidance has been that security and defense, so defending U.S. military, etc., U.S., military government networks, is the first priority. His words are often defense wins. And the way that translates with encryption is that we believe that NSA's work in standards bodies has raised the standard and has really deepened the standards of encryption because we're using those standards that we recommend.
So just to clarify that point, there have been a lot of news stories, as you know, suggesting that NSA worked within the NIST framework to weaken standards. Is that just not true?
NIST is an incredibly respected close partner on many things. I personally have worked with NIST on a number of public-private partnership efforts. Their executive order framework is a good example of that for cyber. And NIST has always been, NIST, as you know, is not a member of the intelligence community. All work that they do is, as we would call, pure white hat. Their only responsibility is to set standards, to protect the whatever they are, whether they're standards for weights and measurements, they showed me some of their old scales, or standards for encryption. So any work NIST does is purely to make those, whatever they are, whether they're encryption or other standards, as strong as they need to be, or as strong as they possibly can be.
In the past, one could argue that there was something of a social contract in which, at least in the United States, in which there were a lot of private sector entities that were indispensable players in the communications environment, and that subject to, especially post-Church Committee, subject to a sense that there was a certain amount of reliable judicial congressional oversight, they were going to cooperate, and often cooperate with great enthusiasm, with the government's need for information through these lawful requests. There are a lot of people who feel that that contract or that mutual understanding and trust has broken down. Does it seem that way to you, that there's been a decline, at least, in that trust?
So a decline in that trust, I think that there's been a general decline in trust in the U.S. government, or in government, let's put it that way, in government. I'll go back to, you know, you asked me how I came to this role. I'll go back for a moment to personal. My dad came to this country as a refugee from communist Hungary. You know, maternal grandparents came as by displaced person camps, also as refugees. And I think there was certainly an understanding during the Cold War of the difference between a democracy and a non-democracy, whether a communist dictatorship, etc., and that there were certain principles that underpin that difference. I think sometimes today, and it goes back to the question you asked earlier, it does seem sometimes that, and we see the difference in the way different people of different ages look at the role of the government, look at the role of that social contract. And I think we're sometimes shaped by our own experiences. To a certain extent, perhaps there's a generation that's grown up when things have always been safe, when there's never been something to be concerned about. If you travel to certain areas of the world, a person of the same age probably has a greater sense of that, either a sense of fear. I know I have friends in various countries around the world where there is that sense that something can happen, there could be a terrorist attack, etc. I think it's a tremendous privilege that as Americans, we don't have that fear necessarily. And I think the perception of that social contract, well, I don't see that my government is doing anything necessarily to provide security, because I believe security is just something I take, something that I accept for granted to a certain extent. Then it becomes, you know, we look at everything as a cost benefit. So if you don't necessarily recognize that there's a differential benefit, perhaps you just see or look at that perception in that way. And I think I see that sometimes, as we're all probably the same generation. And when I talk with colleagues, and I see that perception, those of us who are children of immigrants, particularly those families who came as political refugees or religious refugees, there's a perspective on the uniqueness of the freedoms here, the uniqueness of that, the sense of security and safety, and that it's not something to be taken for granted. And I think perhaps for those who may not have, were a product of our experiences, may not have had those experiences, to your point, there is perhaps a different perspective on that social contract. I think one of General Alexander's fears that he articulates a great deal is a sense that when we look around the world, not every country has that same level of stability and security. And whether it's post-Afghanistan, where we learn that eventually individuals who get training and get arms, sometimes that crosses borders. I think when we look at various troubled areas around the world, whether that's Syria, certainly whether that's in various countries in the Middle East, certainly in areas of Afghanistan, we do sometimes wonder if that level of security, please God, may it stay that way, but perhaps there is it is important for us to communicate the work that's done generally on a day-to-day basis to keep the country safe.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow, it's Inside NSA, Part 5, the final chapter. I talked to Fran Fleisch, the agency's executive director, and now, with the retirement of Chris Inglis, its acting deputy director. She's been there since 1980 and seen it all, but she's never seen anything like the last few months. The Lawfare podcast is produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.